Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. In ancient times, hanging gardens, great pyramids and other superstructures were celebrated as wonders of the world. And like days of the week and deadly sins, there were always seven of them. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? That's the question I ask my guests in this podcast. And the guest I'm asking today is an exciting young comedian. She's appeared on any number of TV and radio shows, gained rave reviews here in Edinburgh and elsewhere for her stand-up comedy. She's also co-founded the LOL Word, which puts on female, non-binary, queer comedy nights in London. Please welcome Chloe Petz. Okay.
Hello, Clive.
Yeah, hello. So, welcome, Chloe. And I have met you before. In fact, I've even interviewed you before. But this is a more meticulous inquiry into your life because it, through the mechanism of these seven wonders. So I hope that was okay to sit down.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very excited to do it because I feel like sometimes at the Edinburgh Fringe, you can sort of lose sight of the important things because you get locked in this bubble. So it's really nice to be able to like reconnect with some important things.
So tell us about your show you're doing, first of all. Now, it's quite a challenging title, your show.
It's called If You Can't Say Anything Nice, and it's basically sort of like an exploration of my own anger because I feel like in the UK, particularly in England, we like to think we're sort of a polite people and we kind of repress all of our anger. But I think that we've got to let it out sometimes. And if you don't do it in a sort of responsible way, then it can come out in negative ways. So I'm sort of trying to encourage people to embrace their angry sides.
So are you suggesting your previous show or shows have been not as angry and it's no more... I don't mean to gender it, but it's no more Mr. Nice Guy this time.
I mean, that is directly a line that I say in my show, is no more Mr. Nice, Chloe.
Okay.
Because I feel like my last show, I sort of, I tried to break big ideas around gender and sexuality in sort of manageable bite-sized chunks. I sort of single-handedly tried to cure transphobia, but you might have noticed, if anything, over the course of the last year, it's got far worse, which is why I've kind of taken this change of tactic. I'm thinking if politeness doesn't work, maybe anger's what I need
it's
to go.
It's certainly got a more prominent discussion point, but you do a week, a monthly comedy club, a comedy performance called LOL, the LOL Word. What's
LOL
that?
Word. So the LOL Word is this, like, it's this sort of mixed bill that we run. I run it with another comedian called Jodie Mitchell, who's absolutely fantastic, like a drag king, has a character called John Travolta, who's fantastic. I would thoroughly recommend their show to
I think I
to
heard that correctly.
Yeah, what I said.
Yes.
And then a double act called Shelf, who are equally fantastic. And we've been running it. We actually started it maybe like 5-6 years ago at the Fringe. And we've been running it ever since. And we just get like queer women, non-binary people to come on and perform. And we do it every month for the Soho Theatre. And it's always just so fun and so uproarious. So come to that as well if you want.
And now the show you're doing here in Edinburgh, it's a whole run in the festival. But then that's going on tour as well. Is that right?
Yeah, that's going on tour. Which again, I really love going on tour. I feel like I don't know. You just get like these special moments with these audiences that are quite unique. Yeah.
So you do one performance in a town and then move on, that sort of tour.
Yeah, that sort of thing. It's great. I absolutely love it.
And including a week as well at the Soho Theatre again to give
yes,
mention
absolutely.
That. So anybody hearing us on the podcast, if it's too late for them to get to Edinburgh, they can track you down the country.
Please, I insist. I would love to have you all there.
Right, jolly good. Right, now let's get on to your wonders then. Mm. So a good range of wonders, some of which I go, oh yeah, and others I go, not sure, which is a perfect combination. But the first one is football. specifically celebrating a goal. So you had me at football, but then you kind of lost me at specifically celebrating a goal. But so now last year when I did a load of these ones, we had a lot of football getting mentioned every now and then, but hardly anything this time. Maybe people have gone off football apart from yourself. So I do know a little bit about you. So you're a football, you support Crystal Palace, which is a, you know, people up here may not have heard of Crystal Palace, but it's a...
We got any Palace fans in? No, okay.
Oh, that's
the loudest silence I've ever heard. Yeah. Have we got any Brighton fans in? No, oh. That's our big rivals.
Yeah. Why are you rivals, Crystal Palace and Brighton?
We're right. It's honestly the dumbest rivalry in the history of football rivalries. What happened is in the 70s, our two managers were rivals from their playing days. Across one season, we played each other five times. And across those five games, it sort of spilled from the players into the pitch, into the stadium, and we've hated each other ever since, which means because two men had an argument over 50 years ago, I now get angry every time I see a seagull.
This is a bad city to be in then, isn't
it? A really bad city. Yeah. You should see me out on George Square just everywhere I go.
Who are the two managers? I'm sorry to delve into...
It was Alan Mullery and... Help me out.
There's nobody else... Oh, the Brighton fans might know.
Alan Mullery and...
Oh, this is fantastic. You can remember the rivalry, not the reason for it.
That's, yeah, of course. Yeah. But this is what football is like. This is why we love football so much, is because I hate... But instinctively, these people in the audience who just cheer for Brighton, they're probably the nicest people you will ever meet in your life, but I immediately despise them. And I can't even remember why. And that's what's fantastic about football. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I just occurs to me, I don't want to go too, you know, serious on this topic, but there was a time, maybe it's died out now, there was quite a lot of sort of homophobic abuse about Brighton fans.
Which yeah, absolutely.
Must have put you in an awkward spot.
Yeah, given, so you can probably tell if you're looking at me live in this room that I am gay. And it probably sort of has permeated the airways as well if you're listening at home. But I just join in. No. I always call it out, and I think the Palace stewards are doing really well at sort of containing it.
Football was notoriously able to take on board
feedback and criticism. Yeah. No, I'm more than happy to call out a big geezer. Well,
now I'm happy to talk about football, but the thing about football is that if you're interested in football, it's an all-absorbing topic. But if you're not interested in football, it's completely dead areas. Like, why should you care whether players wearing a blue shirt should beat a team wearing a red shirt or blue and green hoops? You know, anything like that. You can't really get it. But so can we? I want to hone in on the celebrating a goal aspect. And
maybe this is like a good way of sort of. I do feel quite reticent to sort of speak ad infinitum about football in front of people that don't necessarily connect with it. But I think specifically celebrating a goal is something I feel so sad for people who never get to experience how fantastic, you know, one man scoring a goal and then against another man, or one woman scoring a goal against another woman is. It's absolutely mesmeric. And, yes. You know, and I can completely empathise with the man who put a flare up his bum in Leicester Square. Like, it feels that good, you just want to pop it up there.
But normally they don't do quite as much as that. But I think celebrations have got more and more in the years that I've been watching football. It used to be a sort of a manly handshake was about as far as anybody went. Now they do cartwheels. Yeah. They've got pre-arranged little dance sequences. There's the rocking of a babe in arms if one or the other has just had a baby. Or...
Not an actual baby for those that don't know football. They're not just passing one onto the pitch.
Yeah. All sorts of things. Now... I follow Arsenal, and there was a time when Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang was a player, and he used to do a sort of backflip or a forward flip. And I would think, if I was the manager, I would have said to him, look, it's great to score a goal, but don't do that, because you're going to get it wrong and you're going to break your back halfway through a game. Don't do that. So are you ever worried about the extreme celebrations?
Yeah, well, I'm not. It's not even the extreme celebrations. It's my favourite genre of celebration is a failed knee slide.
Oh, yes.
Because it looks really funny and pathetic when someone's done the coolest thing in the whole entire world, which is score a goal, and then they try and do a knee slide and their knees get stuck in the grass and they just go tumbling over. And it looks really painful as well, but they're having to sort of style it out in front of all of their friends.
Yes.
Like, yeah, I'm fine.
Yeah. So for the non-football fans, somebody's just scored a goal, and instead of saying, "Well, I've scored a goal," they run usually towards the touchline and then they slide on their knees. But if the pitch hasn't been watered enough or they get the angle wrong, it's just ridiculous.
What, do you have a favourite celebration.
No, I don't. I have strong views which don't really accord with yours. I say, I think the first thing, let's say a guy's just tapped the ball into the goal. He is the, it could be a woman, obviously, but he is the goal scorer. Mm. And he goes off celebrating with the crowd. He should have first go to the guy who passed it to him and say, thank you very much for the dribble along the pitch or the accuracy. But they don't often do that. They just ignore their colleague who's assisted it and created the chance and take all the credit for pushing it 6 inches over the line.
Yeah, but it does feel good. I think if I played at the Emirates or something and I tapped a goal in, that would be the best moment of my whole entire life, and I would go doing laps of the
yes.
So I can kind of empathize with why.
What about running towards the away or the opposition supporters
doing an Adebayor?
Yes.
I do feel like ideologically outside of football I'd say I'm a pretty decent person. When it comes to football I'm absolutely horrid, so I think if I did score a goal I would go and bait some away fans and try and make some people really angry at me.
Yeah, well, what is it, there are another couple of issues with this as well. For some reason the last few years players have liked to celebrate goals by taking their shirt off, and that for some reason is regarded as a wrong thing to do. I think it's something to do with annoying the sponsors because they can't see the name of the sponsor at the very moment they want to be able to. But anyway, it's against the rules and the player gets booked for doing it. They get a caution. And now, if I was a manager, I would say to you, but for goodness sake, don't get an extra booking just for celebrating the goal. Don't do that. And yet they still do it.
But do you not think that if you spent that long on making your body look that good, you'd want to show it off?
Well, that's a very hypothetical question in my case. Yes, that comes into it. I wouldn't feel the need to
end
show
of the show. If we have a good podcast recall, Clive's going to unzip it and give you all a little glimpse.
Don't wish that on the world. That's literally nobody wants to see that. You could be the manager of Crystal Palace one day. Would you not say to your players, don't do that? You only get it, and you got a booking for something silly later on the game, and you're sent off. You can't even play in the next game. So,
yeah, I'd say there's absolutely no need. But I guess the counter argument would be the passion overtakes you, and you sort of want to rip your own clothes off. So I couldn't really complain about that, I guess.
Well, I'm sorry to keep dragging you back to Arsenal, but are there anything at the end of one? It was admittedly an FA Cup final. There was a celebration involving Tony Adams and another player. I think it's Steve Morrow. And he managed to break his arm because he fell off Tony Adams. And that was just celebrating the victory. And it wasn't done deliberately and it was in the context of a win. But how stupid is that?
So you're sort of anti-celebration?
I am. I'm very,
we should go back to the civilised handshake?
I'm very dour Puritan person deep down. So,
but when you go and see the Arsenal, what are you doing in the stand when they're scoring?
I leap up. I mean, it sounds laughable in a way, even at my advanced age. I mean, of course, I sometimes anticipate it. And when you do look ridiculous then, because you've leapt up, so nearly a goal. No, that was nearly a goal, wasn't it? Just went round the post. Well, the other thing that mind you, where I sit, there's a fairly, people of a certain age are there, and I'm just showing off that I can leap up. So it's a very dull nil-all draw. I leap up anyway because it's half time. So the other thing that's, we'll get off football in a minute for non-football fans. This goal celebration has now been largely spoiled. The whole essence of a goal has been spoiled for logical reasons, but for unfortunate reasons, because almost every goal now, in fact, every goal has to be checked to see if it was all right. So they have to go to television footage and they go through it in case it was offside, in case there was a handball, in case it didn't cross whichever line. And so you get a double celebration, but neither is as good as just it's a goal.
Yes. I suppose we've sort of learned to like let ourselves go slightly again with VAR, video assistant referee, because you get a sense whether something could have been a bit on the edge and you celebrate the goal and you think, this could be checked. But what I would say, it's added in an extra dynamic of if someone scores against you and they've done a massive celebration and then it gets chalked out for whatever, for VAR, you then get to celebrate back in their face. And there's something very smug and fantastic about that. I'm gutted that I chose football as my first thing, because I think I'm giving a terrible impression to all of you. I promise you I'm a far nicer person than I'm describing.
Well, I think football does bring out the worst in all of us. And in terms of, rivalries and the hatreds and crazy celebrate, all those things are a bit weird. And that's, why we enjoy it, partially.
Yeah, of course.
But what was it that led you into football in the first place? Did everybody at home and your family, are you all Crystal Palace supporters?
Dad's Palace. Well, he always said when I was a child that I didn't have to support Palace if I didn't want to, and that he never forced it on me. But if you see every single picture of me between the age of 0 and 2, I am covered in Crystal Palace paraphernalia. Yes. So I'm not sure how much I chose it or sort of it was forced upon me. But as soon as I was able to go and choose the clothes, I decided to carry on wearing the Palace kit. And I've just loved it ever since. And
I think children pick up the emotional thing of it anyway, that before they even know what football is, they know, oh, come on Palace or come on Arsenal.
I think playing it as well was a big thing, and I feel like there's quite like an innate desire in humans whatever age to, if there's a round thing in front of you, just give it a kick.
Yes.
And I think I just really loved it.
Yes. So do you play football as well?
I played to a decent level up until the age of 16, and then I found it a bit too pressured.
Yeah.
So I fell off, but now I play for leisure now, and I really, really like it.
And are you excited by the rise of women's football? Which is now,
absolutely.
We're recording this in the middle of a Women's World Cup, and here in Edinburgh, I know the excitement is intense for how well the England team is doing. It's especially palpable when the game is on.
I'm really having to wind my neck in. Like, I'm just sort of whispering it's coming home under my breath. Mate, who watched the game? Right, the three of you.
Yeah, that's and they're all Brighton fans, so there's no, you can't even make common cause of that.
I loved it though. It's amazing. And what I would say is, what's cool about the women's game is I've watched it since I was a child, and the quality when I was a child was really poor because they were women that were having to have full-time jobs and train maybe 3 times a week and then play on the weekend, which means that they weren't elite athletes. And it means that every single tournament that you have isn't just a World Cup, isn't just a Euros, it's a marker of how far the game has come.
Right.
And every tournament you come to, sort of Euros every 4 years, World Cup every 4 years, you think it can't get better. And then the quality just absolutely exceeds all your expectations. And you feel quite emotional because like being able to see something developing that way is a really cool thing to have.
It's interesting though to see women footballers behave roughly the same as men footballers, because sometimes you attribute some misbehaviors in life to, well, that's men, that's testosterone, but then you see a woman footballer stamping on the leg of an opponent in just the same way as John Terry would have done when he was playing.
Absolutely.
All those years ago.
Your emotions get away from you. Like when it means so much, you put everything into it, and that can lead to sort of a cloud in judgment. What I will say though is, occasionally though, in the women's game, there'll be a challenge, and I think if that was in the men's game, that would lead to like a 22-man brawl. Whereas in the women's game, they just shake hands and run off smiling. It's lovely.
Well, we'll see. Anyway, well, thank you very much for your first wonder. That's football and the celebrations that you enjoy, and a lot of people enjoy. But I would just stamp out if I was in charge of things. So your next wonder takes it to a completely different area, perhaps a more, I don't know, intellectual area, but it's Raymond Carver short stories.
Oh, yeah, I've forgotten I'd chosen this one.
Right. You can't remember who Robert Carver, Raymond
Carver
is.
Yeah, of course
is,
I can. Yeah. I'm just thinking, can I entertain an audience by talking about it for the next 7 minutes? I'm not sure.
Well, he's an American writer of short stories, obviously. So what led you to him, and what would you want to big up about him?
I think he's the absolute best in the biz. I think that it's like almost like the democratization of literature, because I feel like there's nothing, it's both like super literary but incredibly accessible, because it's telling stories about humans and telling stories about humans in America in these quite
on most works of literature, stories about humans, I mean, other than Watership Down, it's pretty much pretty much the usual subject matter.
I'll take that on board. I'll change my language to maybe like a certain demographic of humans that aren't necessarily hadn't up until that point necessarily been depicted like that within literature, because I feel like he's talking about sort of really gritty stuff like alcoholism, addiction.
So he had quite a roughish life to do with alcohol and to do with it. He came from a modest background, and it got sort of worse even as his literary skills were being developed.
Yeah, and I feel like there's a sort of like honesty to his writing that comes from those issues, where it feels like often it feels like he's writing from the gut, and he'll write these incredible stories, and then I think there's a lot of He'll do a lot of editing to make them sort of literary and satisfactory to read. But I feel like, he's writing from his gut, and he's writing to process, and he's writing to demonstrate real life. And yes. I guess that's what I mean by human. He's demonstrating real life and something that we can recognize, and making that literary.
Yeah. So, and you've specified his short story. So are short stories, is that a form that you particularly like anyway? Not just his, but generally.
I absolutely love it. I think it's maybe my favorite medium of art, because I feel like you can, it feels democratic is a good thing. Like, anyone can do it. And it's easy to read. It's not requiring sort of like your attention for any length of time. You could just pick up one, read it in half an hour, and because it's like it's less like a sort of unfolding novel, it sometimes feels like a stand-up routine where it builds and then there's a punchline or a payoff at the end. It feels like you see a person at like a very significant moment in their life, and then you get to go on that journey with them and just take away something and be like a tiny little bit changed after
it. I'm glad you put it like that, because I once judged a short story competition, and I did an interview about it, and I foolishly, as it turned out, said, well, there is a similarity between a short story and a joke, because very often a short story, you know, proceeds and then there's a twist at the end, as you say, a payoff, like the end of a routine or something. But I don't know where it was published, but then a lot of more literary people than I was perhaps thought I shouldn't have been the chairman of the judges. So how ridiculous. Short stories, lots of different forms. Suggest it's anything like a joke. It just shows. So I won't say that again. But luckily you said it, so I can say, that's an interesting
thing. Yeah, but I also think that's probably more like a snobbiness about stand-up comedy. I feel like we always get seen as like the lowest art form, when actually, famously, we're the highest.
what led you into stand-up comedy rather than, let's say, short story writing? But when did you start doing it? Were you 12, or were you, you know, 22? What was your start?
I feel like I'm going to undermine everything I just said and say I started stand-up because I wasn't good enough to do anything else. but I was an actor. I wanted to be an actor at uni. I did loads of plays and stuff.
Were you studying drama or
I studied English Lit.
Yes.
We had like a really good drama uni or something.
Where was it? Which uni were we
at? UCL.
UCL. So it's a London well supplied university.
Very good. So we would do like plays at the Bloomsbury Theatre.
Yeah.
Every term, and a couple every term, and that was really cool. And I really liked it, but I felt a sense that every character I played, I was always trying to play it for a laugh, even if it was just like Romeo and Juliet or something. I'd be looking like what can be funny here. And when I left uni, I didn't fancy the life of like trying to go to a drama school and then get an agent and be very reliant upon other people to sort of create your work. So I thought, I'll just go and try doing some stand-up. And a teacher had said to me when I was like 15 or something, like, you should do stand-up. Yeah. And it had always been in the back of my head. And then eventually what happened is I just told so many people that I was going to do stand-up that it almost like forced me to do it, because they would hold me accountable. So like I'd say to someone like, I'm going to do stand-up, and then 6 months later I'd bump into them, and they'd be like, did you do stand-up? I'd be like, no. And eventually the guilt became such that I was like, I've got to do this. Yeah. I guilted myself into stand-up.
Can you remember your first gig, your first performance? Did you do an open mic or a 5 minutes somewhere?
Yeah, I did an open mic at a pub called The Rose and Crown, hosted by a man called Andy Onions.
Yes.
And, honestly, I packed it with all of my friends. I was steaming drunk.
It was a good start.
A great start. But like, objectively, if someone had filmed it, probably one of the worst gigs anyone's ever done. But I felt like I smashed it. Yeah. And then the second one was the one that I went to where my feet were solidly back on the ground. And I was like, this is really, really hard.
Yes. Probably best not to do it when you're steaming drunk. Maybe get the audience drunk and then
come on, guys, drink up.
Yeah. You could be a double act. You know, pets and onions would be a great. Not that onions mix with pets very well. If the pet is a dog, they're not supposed to eat onions.
Chloe Pets Onions. No, it doesn't quite work.
No, it doesn't.
No.
Anyway, so you got over the first one, then you got the second one, then you thought, right, no, I think I can do this.
I don't know why I kept at it, because like there were times when I despised it, because it's really scary. It's a really scary thing to do, particularly when you first start doing it and you're absolutely rubbish and you are, but sort of exposing yourself to judgment. Mm. But yeah, there was something within me that just kept me doing it, and I'm glad that I have.
What about hecklers? Are you a good dealer with hecklers?
I love dealing with hecklers. Yes. It's my favourite thing. Yeah, honestly, have at it. I'll take you down. Sometimes I feel like a little bit like I'm cheating a little bit, because I'll like have bits in my show where I sort of invite heckles.
Yes.
I don't know. I just really like it. I really like it when it feels live. In the room, it feels like we're sharing something together as performer and audience.
And do you do that thing that some comedians do? They'll do a, you know, this performance, they'll say, oh, well, there was a time, you know, 6 weeks ago, somebody said to me in the audience, and I said back, and you get the, and it may or may not have happened, but either way, you're getting a laugh out of a heckle that's happened months before.
Yeah, I try not to do that, because I feel like that can be a little bit like a bit of a look how I got this person. I tend to just sort of stick to the heckles that come at me.
All right. So anyway, we're straying slightly away from... So it's Raymond Carver. Is there a particular short story or collection of short stories that anyone who's not read his work should start with?
What we talk about when we talk about love, I think, is an amazing collection. But I read this big... I forget what it was called, but it was a collection of all of them. And that was like an amazing thing to do, because it was like maybe like... 800 or 900 pages of short stories.
Right.
And when you get 400 pages in, you're like, my God, like I think I've read too much of this, because you start seeing a formula, and you can almost like see the scaffolding of how he's hanging things together, and it becomes a little bit like artificial. But then I feel like when you carry on and carry on and carry on, you almost like come out the other side, and the bit that you've noticed about the artifice is now the thing that like you appreciate. And I think it's a really cool way of getting very close to an author, is by just reading so much of their stuff that you almost ruin it and then love it again.
There's a film, Shortcuts, Robert Altman film, that's based on his work.
Right.
Is that a good introduction, would you say?
I haven't seen that.
Oh, right.
Okay. Is it recent, or is it?
1993, which for me is recent. For you, it's prehistory. That's it.
For me, it's the year I was born, Clive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We won't go to the year I was born, but which is prehistory as far as you're concerned. No, it's inspired. I've got a note here. It's inspired by 9 short stories and a poem by Robert Carver. So there's a on his gravestone. Is this his poem? It's a very poignant poem and sort of confident, really. It's called Late Fragment. And did you get what you wanted from this life? Even so, I did. And what did you want? To call myself beloved, to feel myself beloved on the earth. And that's quite a confident way to go out, isn't it?
Yeah, we're like 12 days into the Edinburgh Fringe and I'm feeling a bit emotionally fragile, and that is going to give me a little glass. Beautiful.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Your third wonder is running along a canal in the sunshine.
Yeah, I love it. Yes. I love going for a run. I'm not very good at it, but I can just plod for a long time. And it's, I really value having something in my life that I'm not trying to be the best at.
Yes.
I just do it because it's fun.
Yeah.
And then running along a canal, it's very beautiful and you get these moments of beauty. But then you also get people that walk so annoyingly and get in your way that you get a little bit pissed off, and then that makes you run faster. I love it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, but if you're a walker along the canal side, you have to put up with these runners that come up.
Yeah, get out of my way! Yeah. And then coming through!
And then there's the cyclists that annoy everybody.
Right,
or
the
annoy
cyclists. Yeah. I think cyclists, you're fantastic people. I think what you're doing for the planet is absolutely wonderful, but get the fuck off my canal is what I would say. You don't belong there. I'll push you in.
There's a section of a canal here in Edinburgh. It's down by Fountain Bridge, which is there's some university buildings. There's a little mishmash of redevelopment going on there. But alongside the canal, there's some beautifully laid out sort of, I don't know if everyone know that bit of the canal around there. And the beauty of it, apart from anything else, is it's quite a longish section where it's really wide. I mean, it's absolutely, there's none of those problems about, because sometimes the canal, especially the ones I'm familiar with in London, where there are little bridges and narrow bits.
Yeah,
and it's very
yeah.
difficult for everybody to be accommodated. There are people cycling, people running, walking, people selling drugs. They've all got to try and fit into the same area. Here, it's all wide open spaces.
We know what Clive's been up to this fringe. Yeah, that wide open space is really good. And then when you get to the viaduct, that's when it's sort of you're teetering on falling in.
Yeah.
But yeah, the wide open space. I do still feel like people sort of behave like gases in public spaces, though, where they just sort of spread out as wide as they can and aren't necessarily that good at getting out of each other's way. Come see my show. I talk a lot about this. I get very sort of angry about the etiquette of people on the streets. Yeah.
So do you tick off cyclists who are cycling on the pavement and things like that? Or
what, give them like a
you're hitting down at walkers, slow
no,
walkers?
No, no. If a cyclist was on the street, I think I'd give them a stare and a tut.
Yes.
I think is what
it's
I do.
The British way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I feel like the only thing less acceptable in this country than being a selfish twat is telling someone that they're being a selfish twat.
Yes.
So I think, yeah, that's why we've developed the tut in this country.
Yes. And without wanting to stereotype, in America, you'd just shoot them. It would be... there'd be...
Yeah, perfect. Yeah.
All right. So running along canal. And is this part of an intense... you know, keeping yourself in trim sort of exercise scheme. I've noticed with approval the fact that the figure that you're supposed to walk 10,000 steps a day has just been updated, and it's down to 5,000 now. It's normal. It's going to get down to me in another couple of reassessments.
Are you serious? Who said that?
The 10,000 figure, sounds like somebody knows more about it than I do. I'll come to that in a moment. The 10,000 figure was an arbitrary figure culled from nowhere.
Right.
And then somebody's looked into it, and they've said that basically 5,000. That's about it. 5,000 is as good, isn't it? There we are. So anybody who's just had a little bit of a long walk to come and see this, you've basically covered yourself already. You go home and do my system, forget your keys at the top of the house, walk up and down it several times. That's perfect.
Oh, great. Oh, well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
No, I'm not sort of like, I'm not like a mad exerciser. I think in my early 20s, I was grossly unhealthy. And then when I hit my late 20s, I was like, I probably should do something about this.
Yeah.
I had a sort of spell of wanting to do half marathons, and I did do a half marathon. But I found that trying to train for half marathons whilst doing various different comedy festivals isn't necessarily sort of conducive to best health. So I got like a knee injury and stuff. So now I just like go on 5Ks just to keep the brain happy.
How do you behave at in a festival like this? I don't inquire into your private life, but some people,
terribly.
Some people, you know, they're up all night, you know, in bars drinking in a way they might not do if they were on their own touring around or just not performing at all. And they can come back at the end of 3 weeks or whatever it is at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe with extra weight and a damaged liver and whatever else they've done.
I'm certainly damaging my liver. I'm 100% doing that. I feel like I walk and run loads when I'm here. So that sort of keeps things in check.
Yeah.
I would say my diet's pretty terrible, but I try and have like two good meals a day, and then one meal can be a bit of a like throw it away kind of thing.
Yes.
But I do stay up to the bars. But as you know, I'm 29 now. I am starting to feel hangovers a little bit more than I was when I was 22. So I have to... I'm careful with it. I'd say I sort of have like a two night on, one night off policy.
Oh wow, that's quite a lot. But but 29. If you keep going through another couple of decades, it comes good again. You can cope with the hangovers again. Yeah, I think so.
Do you agree with that, everyone?
No. Oh, all right. good to get some actual crowdfunding of opinions.
I've never heard that before.
I just thought I'd tipped over to a new era. Maybe I just don't care anymore. But, or maybe I'm being more sensible and I don't realise it. But anyway, we might come back to that topic in one of your wonders later on. So I'm anxious. I want to get through. I'll keep my eye on the time to get onto the fourth wonder, because people in the audience have got other shows to go to. And
I've got my show to go to.
All right. Yeah. What time does your show start?
My show starts at 6:40.
All right. We'll be over minutes before then. So your fourth wonder is a show called And Juliet.
Right.
So some people may have seen this. Some people won't. They might have heard of it. But just describe what the show is, first of all.
I saw this show in Melbourne, And Juliet. It's a jukebox musical of the music written by the Swedish music producer Max Martin. Tell me if I'm getting any of this wrong, Clive.
Yeah.
And
well, can I just interrupt? He's credited with that. But there's also other, you know, it's a jukebox musical as well. It's got pre-existing songs in it as well.
So it's basically all of the songs that he's written.
Oh,
so
I see. They're all connected.
He never sings them. So it's like he has written them for people like Katy Perry, Britney Spears, NSYNC.
I get it. So he's obviously written lots and lots of songs.
Every 30 seconds, there'll be another song that comes on and you're like, he wrote this one as well? This is crazy. And basically what happens is me and my friends, we went to see it in Melbourne, and for the first 15 minutes, we thought, this is one of the worst things we have ever seen. It would essentially like cue in. There'll be like a really cheesy line. So there's a non-binary character in it who goes, I guess you could say, I just feel like I'm not yet a girl, not yet a woman, and then start singing the Britney Spears song. And you think, what the hell is going on? You cringe so hard, your eyes go back in the back of your head. But then 15 minutes pass, and you sort of adapt to the fact that this is the world you're existing in now. And you're sort of like, well, this feels right. And then what happens is you realise that all of the cast are sort of in on the joke as well. And it just becomes this like uproarious, uplifting, cheesy camp experience that is like amazingly performed. They're incredible singers, incredible dancers. The band is insane, and everyone just by the end is on their feet. And it's one of the like greatest experiences I've ever had in a theater.
Oh, right.
And absolutely astounding.
And it sort of it starts with Romeo and Juliet, and it's sort of, and it's giving a different ending to Romeo and Juliet, or taking on the story.
Yeah, so it's absolutely mad. So it's basically like William Shakespeare and Anne Hathaway are having a conversation with each other, and Anne Hathaway goes, why did you have to do that to Juliet? She's just got rid of this bloke. That should be the start of her life, not the end of it. She shouldn't be killing herself.
So she's woken up and found that he's dead. And in the original, she kills herself then. Anne Hathaway says, no, she should get rid of this bloke. It's a bit of a harsh way to say this guy who was in love with her, and she was in love with him.
Yeah,
and
but she was 14, Clive.
Yes.
She's got a whole life ahead of her. Yeah. Come on.
Let's not stress the age thing, because that makes it sound like she's got rid of Jimmy Savile. It was...
but, you know, we've all lost a husband and moved on.
If you're triggered by this conversation, anybody, please.
You have to, Clive. You have to give trigger warnings before you say the thing.
Yeah. Well, I was. But you said it. I was just. I was just trying to help.
Retroactive trigger warning. So then Anne Hathaway is like to William Shakespeare, "You've got to rewrite. You've got to do a sequel."
Yeah.
And Juliet is the sequel of what Juliet gets up to once Romeo's. It sounds mad, and it is mad, but go and see it and you'll see that the madness pays off.
So it's a Swedish songwriter, so it's a bit like Mamma Mia, but added to Romeo and Juliet and added to all the other musical conventions.
There's a lot going on in it. It's absolutely bizarre. And like, it's one of those things where you're like, how did this get made? Like, how did someone, after all of the descriptions that I've just given, imagine being in a pitch room and someone be like, yeah, let's do that.
Yeah.
Mad.
But especially jukebox musicals, there are other strange things, aren't they? Because some work, well, like Mamma Mia, and like the Queen one, We Will Rock You,
yeah.
which don't sound very promising on paper either. But as long as the music is enticing enough and there's something about the story, it'll succeed. But, you know, with all theatre productions, two or three succeed, another 20 fail. That's
yeah.
That's the joy of being a theatre promoter, or the angst of it, if that's what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, yeah, I feel like the Take That one isn't
yeah.
necessarily fantastic.
Well, yes. You've got to find the sort of music that several generations of people will relate to in some way. For example, there was a Madness musical. It's a perfectly good musical, but it's a surprisingly narrow range of people really want to hear Madness songs done on stage by not Madness.
Yeah, and there's like two Madness songs that you'd like to hear, and then yes. after that you're like, well, I think I'm done, yeah. I'll go home now.
Whereas Queen, almost every one of their tracks is now locked into everyone's
Absolutely.
Brain.
Yeah.
And it could, you know, people will enjoy that, whatever the storyline, the rather fantastical storyline that links them all together. This sounds like I'll be open about it. I haven't seen it. It started in London, but it's gone around the world, as you say. I go to the theatre a lot because I interview actors and things. But in consequence, I only see shows really connected with somebody I'm interviewing, and I just haven't interviewed anybody in connection with this show. But I'm obviously aware of it, and it's it won three awards, the Olivier Awards, which is the top awards in London in 2020. So it's commercially done very well. So
yeah.
So,
yeah.
But that's a wonder of the world as far as you're concerned.
I think that experience of watching it with all of my friends in Melbourne and just being absolutely blown yeah. away and euphoric is my wonder of the
Do
world.
Do you go to lots of musicals? Are you judging it against lots of, or is this just so you happen to be out on a night out and you now remember it fondly?
No, I love musicals. I really love musicals.
Yeah.
Maybe musicals more broadly would be one of my wonders of the world. I think they're so fantastic. And some of my best theatre experiences have been like, watching musicals.
Well, odd enough, I haven't been drawn to that simply because I haven't been given the free tickets. But I think you make a good make a good case for that. But let's go on to number five, which is karaoke.
Yeah.
So this is presumably you singing along joyously and hopefully tunefully in the company of friends, or how do you enjoy karaoke?
Yeah. Well, I feel like I'm a good karaoke singer because I think I'm good enough that when you're drunk, it seems impressive, but bad enough, it doesn't look like I'm showing off. And
yes.
I think
that's a fabulous excuse. Let's enjoy a night out. You will realize I'm not showing off so we can all enjoy me. That's a
yeah.
very good idea.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I feel like as well, what I said earlier about why I started stand-up is because if I could be a singer or a musical theatre actor, that is 100% what I would have done. I just don't have the talent, which is why I'm poncing around doing what I do instead.
Yes.
So karaoke sort of gives me like that glimpse of like yeah. pretending I'm the front man of a band. And I really adore it with a fervent passion.
Yes. And so you have to go a little way to convince me on this. Not that you have to convince me, but just because I think people who like karaoke, it is great fun. Where was I recently? I think it was Devizes. Anyway, I was on my own doing a show and I came back late-ish at night, not middle of the night, but late at night. And there was over the other side of the road from the place I was staying, there was a karaoke bar. And if you got sort of just far enough away, you couldn't quite really hear the music anymore, but you could hear the voices of the singers.
The wailing
people. And
they
were unremittingly awful. I mean, that's no reason why they shouldn't do it. But you think, blimey, O'Reilly, those are bad singers. That's even bad by my standard. I can hear how bad it is. So you've got to be there in the room doing it and throwing yourself into it enthusiastically. Otherwise,
yeah, absolutely. And I think there's something so cathartic about just like wailing from the depths of your stomach, even
yes.
if it sounds terrible to everyone else. You're getting something from it.
Yeah.
Have you never really done it?
I'll tell you a particular occasion I did it. This is slightly worrying to me. One of the other people doing it was a guy called Phil Pope, who was a brilliant singer. He did the songs on Spitting Image. He usually did the singing. He can do any rock band. He was in a show called Radioactive, and they had the heebie-jeebies. They did a version of the three of them did it, but he basically did the voices in the Radioactive. He can do anybody. He's a friend of mine, and he's very, very good. And I can remember even now the song he did. We all struggle with very simple songs. He did Purple Rain by Prince, which is almost impossible for Prince to sing, but he did it perfectly. And you think, great, Phil, but I'm not saying he was showing off because he couldn't help but do it really well. And that has sort of scarred me a bit from karaoke, thinking that was a very inadequate performance I put in whatever I sang.
I love those moments, though, where someone like does something completely unexpected and like blows you away.
Yeah.
And Purple Rain is such a beautiful song. Like in the karaoke context, I think that would doubly sort of.
It's quite hard to do though. The timing is very, very difficult to get right.
And it's very long as well. Yeah. That's, you've got to avoid that in karaoke.
No, it was longer the better, as far as I'm concerned. The longer he was doing it, the less time I wasn't doing it.
What did you sing?
I can't even remember what day. I was given a comic song to sing. So it wasn't even a sing. I didn't choose it. I was allocated it, and it was not even a singing challenge. It was trying to fit the words into a comic song. And who likes comic songs in the first place?
Well, don't be saying that too loudly at the Edinburgh Fringe.
Oh, I suppose so.
Clive, I'm going to some karaoke this Sunday.
All right.
Do you want to come with me?
Do you know?
Imagine me and Clive rocking up to karaoke together.
I so want to come to that, but unfortunately... I'm not in Edinburgh on Sunday, but so I can't.
If you had to come,
yes,
and you had to sing a song, what song would you choose?
Oh, that's good. I think a sort of screechy, you know, loud, shouty song. You know,
I think
Bruce Springsteen or Rod Stewart, maybe just something that you can really belt out in a loud way.
I think Bruce Springsteen is right. What about something like "Bat Out of Hell" or something like
that? Oh yeah, I'd love to do it, but I think that again is quite a hard song to sing. I think it's beyond my singing ability.
But again, it's not about that. It's just about screaming with enthusiasm.
Yes, I think you've got my level there. Anyway, so karaoke. Are you not worried about you rely upon your voice as a comedian. You're not worried about losing your voice or, you know, doing a karaoke night after a show. The next night, you could hardly speak. You're not worried about that?
Yeah, but we're like, again, we should worry more about that, but I don't think we consider ourselves to be like artists. Like actors would do like a big vocal warm-up and stuff like that, whereas we'll just like snort a line of Lemsip or something and be like, yeah, I'll be all right.
Yes, okay.
But I love it. I love it. I am... Simply the Best, Tina Turner.
Yes, a very popular song in some parts of Scotland.
It's I find that it's obviously she sings it like out astoundingly well.
Yes,
but it is quite like, if you'll notice, it is quite one note the whole way through. So it's like easier than you think it's going to be.
How about River Deep Mountain High, which I think she was bleeding by the end of the recording. She had to do it so many times.
Oh, really?
Yes. She had an abusive husband, Ike Turner.
What? Well,
And then
I'm going to give you a retroactive trigger warning.
Yeah. And as a way of sort of getting away from him, she was then produced by Phil Spector, who paid Ike not to be in the recording studio because he didn't want him there, and then made her do it so many times she was exhausted by the end of it, creating one of the best records of all time, which flopped completely in America, interrupting his career. And anyway, so that's a bit of pop music.
No, that's amazing trivia. I'm a big Tina Turner fan. Maybe I should have put Tina on the list.
Yes.
Yeah, I love it.
Karaoke. We've got to move on. We stay in the area of music, though, with Lady Gaga. It's a wonder of the world.
Okay, this is why I didn't choose Tina. It was probably a toss-up between the two of them.
Yeah.
I'm a massive Lady Gaga fan. I think she's an outstanding performer. I think she is a gift to us all. And I don't know. I feel like she just is a demonstration of a person who just, like, worked and worked and worked at her craft. Yeah. Like she was going to, you know, 3 singing lessons a week, 4 dance classes, acting classes. And I feel like she's just created this machine of just the most outstanding performer that we have in this generation of musical talent.
Yeah. Just a bit of spice to the conversation. Did you not sometimes feel she sort of tries too hard in the sort of publicity way, certainly at the beginning, to attracting more and more, a little bit of outrage, a bit of crazy clothing. That slightly put me off a bit.
Talking about the meat dress, Clive?
I'm talking about the meat. I think she's vegan, isn't she? But at the time, she had a dress made out of meat, or appeared to look...
I'm a vegetarian that will occasionally indulge in some meat, so
judge. You wouldn't wear a meat dress, would you? Or would you?
That's the big reveal at the end of the show. I take my top off and I've got a little meat crop top on. Yeah,
right. Well, we've all got a little meat crop top underneath our clothing, haven't we? But some of us not quite so cropped anymore. But
well, when you do your little strip at the end, we'll all see it. Yeah. What was the question?
Well, I must stop mentioning this. But I did an interview, because she's recently died. It's been on my mind. I had an interview with Sinead O'Connor.
Oh yeah.
And I thought she compared to some other people, she had her moments and people want to go, but she always was, I felt, speaking from a point of honesty. She had her opinion. Sometimes it changed to different things, but she was always there with it. Whereas there are other, you know, highly publicizing female and male singers, sometimes sound outrageous things. And I'm not sure they really mean it. They've worked out, oh, if I say that, if I do a video set in a church or something, that'll attract attention. That's how I approached Lady Gaga, but I'm not an expert on her. So, and I know she's made a lot of great records. But anyway, she's a wonder as far as you're concerned.
Yeah, but I do think like that there can certainly be some like cognitive dissonance around it, and acknowledge that all of this stuff is absolutely true, but I still love her. But I think maybe we're just like in this bind with like extraordinarily famous people at the moment, where when we started getting the cult of celebrity, there was something uncynical about celebrities having their public facing life, not just when they're on stage as a performance.
Yes.
So, you know, when you're doing an interview or you're on a red carpet, there's something like, the art is the cult of personality that they've created. Yeah. I think probably the difficult thing about that now in the age that we're living in, because we are living in sort of the most capitalism there has ever been, when they create this cult of personality where it's the art is their self, that's when it becomes more cynical, because you know that is to make as much money as physically possible.
Yeah.
So I don't think we can certainly criticize the structure within which Lady Gaga exists, and we can criticize her participation in it, but she's not not the only one doing it.
She's done what she's had to do to get the attention, sure, so she can make the record. Well, if anyone's saying, well, I'm not sure about Lady Gaga, is there a track or a song of hers that you would say go with that, or that album, that record?
Telephone, that she does with Beyonce, greatest pop track of all time in my opinion.
Oh right, okay.
Born This Way, song and album.
Poker Face, people know. Is that good or not?
Poker Face is really good. It's not on my favorite album, I would say. But I think like Alejandro and those sorts of quite anthemic songs are certainly like you can't put it on and not want to dance.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
I love her.
And it's a great name, Lady Gaga. I think it comes from the Queen track, doesn't it? Radio Gaga. I think that's where she got the name from.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think so. I only know the trivia. I don't know anything about I can't tell you how to write a tune or sing one. But it must be funny when she's meeting, I don't know, the King or the Queen or whatever. Oh, this is Lady Gaga. Oh, I thought, are we related? I'm sure we've got somebody in the family we used to call that. Anyway, Lady Gaga, we are running out of time, so we've got on to your seventh and last wonder, which is beer before dinner.
Oh, I love it. I love it. It's something I developed over the pandemic is where I'd have nothing to do, so I'd be waiting for Pointless to start at 5:15. Because I was like, when Xander and Richard are on the screen, it's acceptable for me to drink.
Okay.
That was my policy.
That's 3/4 hour earlier than the traditional 6 o'clock start.
Xander and Richard, yes, okay. The special circumstances. Yeah. And what I would do...
Why don't you become the Chase fan, and then you could start at 5 o'clock, which is... don't recognize The Chase, obviously, as a rival.
I would do is I would watch Pointless live, and then I'd go to ITV Plus One and watch The Chase.
Oh, okay.
After.
All right. I can see you're a hardworking stand-up comedian. Always getting down to work. Right?
Well, you know, I could have done a 9-to-5 of writing jokes before Pointless. Yes. I didn't, but I could have. And yeah, it'd be my favorite thing to, you'd have a beer, like, and you maybe if you'd had lunch at like 1 or something, it'd be a bit of an empty stomach. So you'd have one beer and you'd feel the perfect level of tipsy. And then when you have dinner, it almost feels like a drunk meal.
Yeah.
Which I think is the tastiest food ever is okay. 3 o'clock in the morning. So I found that I sort of created this moment for myself where the food became like immediately heightened because the beer had sort of like unleashed my taste buds.
Okay.
And now if I can sort of reproduce that feeling, I do it whenever I can.
Okay. So if the drink, the beer happens at 5:15 or thereabouts, when do you actually eat the dinner? Is that, Is that sort of at 6 o'clock or is it not until 8:30?
About 6:45.
6:45.
Yeah. No, I'm not getting really tanked up, Clive. I'm not starting at 5:15 and then eating at 9 after I've had about 7 pints.
Yes.
That would be what we call alcoholism.
Yeah.
No, what I'm describing is fun and kooky.
Yes.
And definitely not a problem.
I'm not suggesting it's a problem, but alcohol has been mentioned several times throughout these wonders. Karaoke is essentially a drinking thing. This is a beer before the football. Anyway, so I'm just slightly worried about your
yeah. We can discuss that after the show.
Yes. But you prefer that, or that's preferable to say having a meal, postponing drinking to having a meal and then having a, you know, a drink afterwards when you've got a full stomach and you can perhaps take it in not...
You can drink during the meal as well.
I take your point. You want alcohol with everything, but I'm just saying sometimes there's an argument for having it during and afterwards rather than beforehand because, you know, the alcohol can go straight into your system and make you drunker than you might need to be.
Exactly.
Okay.
No, but they're another wonder of the world, I suppose, would be doing none of that and having a glass of red wine with like some delicious pasta.
Yes.
I like that too. I can be classy with it as well.
Okay. So it's a beer rather than a cocktail that some people like, you know, a cocktail hour when they've got a mixture of alcohols getting them absolutely smashed before they have dinner. But a beer is quite modest in comparison to that.
Yeah, it is. But it feels, I don't know, it feels like an amazing treat, a beer.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we have now run out of time. So thank you very much. We've just about got through all of your 7 wonders. So thank you very much for sharing it with us. Before I give you a round of applause, I do have to select your wonder of wonders. Which of the wonders I felt on the basis of how you argued it. There are one or two that you've been very convincing on. I don't think I'm going to take up running along canal, though, to be honest, or karaoke. I'm not sure I'm convinced about Lady Gaga, but you have intrigued me, and I have now definitely thought of I must see And Juliet. So I'll make And Juliet your wonder of wonders. So
thank you.
Thank you very much. Chloe Pets. Thank you very much, Chloe Pets.
If you enjoyed this episode of My 7 Wonders, it would be wonderful if you could rate and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you found us. Thank you for listening.
My 7 Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.